better at just bullshitting about ultra left tactics.
I think it's always better when we just go for it.
I think so. The first couple minutes are always like, wait a minute, what are we supposed to do? But what are you gonna do?
It's fine.
Oh, now all this stuff's fucked up again. Hang on. No, wait. No, that's fine. That's all fine. Hopefully I sound fine. I mean, there have been some issues where maybe I don't sound fine, but if I go back and listen to it and I sound like shit, you know, it's just going to be one of those episodes. We haven't had one in like 50 episodes, so, you know, so what?
Yeah. I don't know. I bought a newspaper today.
Was it a socialist appeal newspaper?
It wasn't a socialist appeal newspaper, actually. No, I thought in the interests of plurality of socialist sects, I would buy the newspaper of their arch rivals, the Socialist Party of England and Wales.
There's
one very stalwart guy who attends a lot of protests and just stands in the high street and stands there with his newspapers. And I'm sure he has pleasant conversations and unpleasant conversations with anybody who makes themselves available. Other than that, he just stands there in a stalwart fashion. And,
have you had much of a chance to compare it to the socialist appeal paper?
I haven't read it at all. No, I feel like I'm probably going to disagree with it in all the same ways, and that's going to make the whole situation even more hilarious by virtue of the fact that they hate each other so much.
Yeah,
I don't know whether the hatred is mutual. I almost told him part of the reason why I was buying this paper is because I had a run-in with somebody from Socialist Appeal, and literally the first thing they said to me was, oh, you know, there's that guy around here from selling the socialist. We're not them. I was just like, I mean, I'm the one person who probably already knows that. And anybody else you're saying that to really doesn't care.
Yeah, but you care more in like an anthropological sense. You're more so like, fascinating. Tell me more.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what game it is. It's a preamble to a game of some sort. I don't know what it is exactly. Maybe I'm just gonna, I don't know. I'm just gonna engage the.
You're playing both sides.
Yeah. No, I'm just making an engagement with the present left. You know, I can build some bridges. Maybe I'll be the bridge builder.
You are doing Marxist unity in buying multiple newspapers.
in buying the newspapers and whatever, reading them and finding them identical.
Yeah, I will say the people out here who do the exact same thing, where they're selling the socialist at one end of town and then socialist appeals paper at the other end of town. Socialist appeal people. You know, they're kind of typical like sect people, but they do tend to be a bit more maybe nice. Maybe nice isn't the right word, but a bit more
socialist appeal.
Yeah, a bit more approachable, I've found, at least out here. Maybe it's just because I know some of them and it's just like, oh, there they are. You know?
Yeah, and they're all the students, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, that's probably it.
There's something about that. I don't know what it is about that exactly. Yeah. Yes, maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Anyway, it's better formatted. I think.
Which one? Socialist.
The Socialist.
Oh, the Socialist.
The Socialist has much better formatting than the Communist. for sure. Looks very much like a Morning Star clone, really. Mm. Anyway, this is not the paper review.
This is the graphic design review.
Auxiliary statements to. We should do that one day. We could do like they do on the news. But
exactly. We did our tier list for new Centerbeast Warhammer models, we should do a tier list for the graphic design of different Marxist projects.
No, I feel like we just like do the breakfast show, reads the papers, and we'll just have a panel and we'll just talk about the various news from the various socialist papers of the week. I'd be up anyway.
On this week, the Weekly Worker is hassling everybody else, and the Socialist is hassling everybody else.
Yeah. We could have like a sectarian of the week, you know, and see who's been the most accomplished sectarian, you know.
Yeah, I would like to see what the bar is for most accomplished sectarian.
Like, I mean, I don't know. What is the metric? You know,
It could be you.
Like, I can't award. That would be. I can't award myself the award. That would be. I don't know.
What are you gonna do? Yeah. Well, I think you're just pining for a little bit of sectarianism after we read some more ultra left material this week. We seem to be we spoke about this a while ago about not necessarily being pigeonholed, but there are some, we've established some people who listen to the show who are probably like more ultra left in their leanings, which is cool, which, you know, hey, right on. And funnily enough, those people, whether they make up an outsized proportion of whoever listens to the show or whatever, or not, they tend to be much more open with reaching out and being like, hey, you should read this. This thing's pretty cool. You should read this. I mean, it would be really funny if we just got people being like, there was this great article in The Socialists today. You should read that. That would be amazing. That'd be
Yeah, here's
funny.
A piece by Pol Pot. You should read that.
Exactly. Yeah, be wary of Pol Pot. Dan does have glasses, so be wary of that. Yeah, yeah.
I had to set my contact lens there. They were itching too much.
Well, I like the glasses. You have very nice looking glasses. It's fine. So maybe we just get right into it. Right into it, I say, after we've been on like a diatribe about sectarian newspapers in England. So two separate people about a couple weeks ago reached out to us. Two people within the course of like a day, which I thought was very funny. And then I think I later found out that they know each other. Uh-huh. So two people, one of them, their name was Matt, and the other one's name, I think, was Phil. Phil? No, not Phil. Phil wrote this book. Ian. So Ian reached out to us first and was like, hey, keep up the good work, everybody. You should. The email began by being like, in the vein of Endnotes and Matic. I was like, yes, read more. Excellent. And they both basically suggested this book, which we read for this week. We read an entire book, which is Hinterland by Phil Neal, which was published... should have looked 2018. This up. Published, yeah, 2018, I think. He talks about writing it in 2016, but yeah, published in 2018. So it's one of the more recent things we've ever read, if not the most recent thing. And what it is it's like supposed to be a communist like geographical analysis, or like new geographical analysis in the vein of a lot of these kind of like the people that we've come across for the show before. You're more like French ultra-leftist types, again, like, you know, Endnotes. But then also, like, there's a bit of a Jack Kmat jump scare in here. I saw that in the page before I knew that this was, like, an ultra-left text. And I was like,
Yeah, there's some Bordiga and...
there's some Bordiga and what have you. The Invisible Committee gets quoted, which is pretty good. Yeah. But basically, it's the subtitle of this book is America's New Landscape of Class and Conflict. And it's kind of trying to put forward a new geography that kind of gets past... the typical things that the ultra-left are trying to get past, you know, proletariat, the people that work in the factories, these need to be the people that do the revolution or whatever. But then also in a geographical sense, like it's trying to get past ideas of, you know, the urban centers versus the suburban centers versus rural divides. Like Phil Neal here is kind of putting forward this idea of the hinterland, which is kind of, you know, we'll get into what exactly that is and how he further kind of like subdivides it. But it's this new theater of class conflict that is... you know, perfectly aligns with the ultra-left ideology in some pretty interesting ways. Honestly, I did really enjoy this book. It's written in a way that I feel like we don't read a lot of things that are written like this other than every ultra-left thing that we read. You know, it's written in like kind of more flowery prose. There's a lot of like personal experience in here. But at the same time, it's also kind of similar to like Mike Davis and its analysis and stuff. So I appreciated it. Much appreciated to Matt and Ian for turning us on to this. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I think you're right about the somewhat, you say flowery prose, that's definitely true, that accompanies these autobiographical sections. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember from the start this sort of like declared intent to have there be this autobiographical section to it. So there were periods when I was reading and I was wondering, like, is this really one person's account, or are these sort of like almost stories designed to add sort of narrative flow to an otherwise academic text? And it really feels like it does alternate between the two quite a lot. So I was doing a lot of like parsing out the slightly more academic bits from the more literary ones. I also thought there was like almost like a sci-fi quality to some of the literary sections. Like I felt like he could be describing the landscape of another planet, or like the class divide of some other society. Maybe that's just because I don't recognize this society that he is describing, because I sort of never experienced, like, I've never been to the United States at all, but never experienced the sort of non-coastal inland and the sort of hinterland that is behind the sort of metropolises of coastal and Central America, you know what I mean, Central North America.
Yeah, a place.
But actually, we were just joking before that you were saying that you didn't realize on starting this text just how sort of like ultra left or communizer it was going to become. And I was saying that, like, I was definitely duped by it in a similar way, but I was quite pleased about that, because later on when he starts referencing the Invisible Committee, and I was sort of thinking about other texts that I've encountered in the past that share this politics and why they haven't impacted me. And I think he uses the same language that you described, actually, to describe the Invisible Committee's texts as being sort of having flowery French prose and this kind of thing, which have always made it very difficult for me to really understand what the actual material argument that's being made, or rather what the historical and material driving forces are meant to lie behind what initially feels like a somewhat fictitious and hopeful description of a future revolution predicated on riot and the otherwise like sort of like non-traditional depictions of the proletariat. Yeah. And so I was really pleased that this text, and it's one of the advantages, is it has this title Hinterland, and it starts, what underlies it is primarily a material analysis of the it's not exactly the geography, but there are geographic elements, but sort of like all of the material components that go into creating the present landscape of class in contemporary American society. And it's that first, and then the politics that comes from that. It's this sort of like left-com politics, and I was grateful. It's the sole text that I've read that has this politics that has allowed me to understand, accept, even see a lot of virtue and merit in this description. That feels like quite high praise, actually. I think it's deserved. I really did enjoy it. It was very enjoyable.
And yeah, a couple of things. I think I totally agree in terms of like the way that he describes a lot of the politics of this kind of the kind of like, as we're used to reading, the kind of like French ultra left stuff. Like I said on the show a while ago, like last year on vacation, because I'm a loser, I read the Invisible Committee. What's the book?
You read Gilles Dauvet, did you?
No, I read The Coming Insurrection?
Or?
The Coming Insurrection. Yeah. And there's the line that he quotes in here about like the riots and the revolutionaries making their ways to the urban centers and finding that they're like, you know, I forget the metaphor that's exactly used, but like empty, they are the empty promises of revolution. It's like they go to these urban cores, and the thing that they're looking to find, this like physical epicenter of capital, is not there because these buildings are all empty, and it's just like the cops just wait for them all to go home or just kick the shit out of them, right? And I kind of didn't really ever understand what that meant until actually reading this, because when I read it I was like, whoa, that's badass, and I was like, I actually don't know what that means. And he does a really good job of explaining not just that specific line, but like a lot of the kind of more pro-riot, anti-strike, kind of anti-workerist kind of stuff that you find in like French ultra-left stuff or just ultra-left stuff in general. And I did really appreciate it. It's interesting though, I'm interested, we'll get into kind of like what the hinterland is and stuff like that, but out here, so Dan and I met in the south of England, like an hour's commute, basically in Canterbury, basically, right? Like an hour's commute from London for people who aren't familiar. And the kind of this part of Kent, and specifically more so like East Kent, is really kind of like an interesting, just England in general is so interesting in terms of its class structure and geography, because I was really doing some thinking too. I was like, how familiar am I with this idea of the hinterland or what it is that he's actually describing? And out where I'm from, there are a lot of it's like a mixture of a bit closer to the coast. It's like, you know, coastal elite kind of stuff and like vacation places or whatever, right? But then also like it's heavily rural and there's a massive Amazon logistics center that got built a couple of years ago, right? Smack dab that employs a bunch of people, right? And so I was like, okay, so like I recognize a lot of what he's talking about here, but then in England, it's so strange because it's like you could seemingly apply a lot of this vocabulary to England, but then the weird thing is it's like, I don't know, there will be a kind of hinterland type area, some of the more like rundown coastal elements specifically around here, right? Like Dover or like some of the like East Kent places, maybe in Thanet. But then it's like you go like a mile inland and then there's like a fucking like palatial estate that's like still owned by like some baron that's on 100 acres, you know what I mean? It's just like, it's so strange. So my point in bringing all this up is that he really says that he makes the point that the hinterland, this idea of the hinterland, is a global phenomenon. Capitalism is global and this is a global phenomenon. But it was interesting to me kind of being like, well, how much can I apply this to like my own personal experience? I don't know. It's strange. England specifically. I don't know. It might just be a whole other kettle of fish, but yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I feel like there are particular things in his narrative which relate specifically in some ways just to the geographical scale of the United States and how its infrastructure and how the flows of capital cross it. There, I think there's degrees to which, particularly in Kent, as you're describing, where there are pockets of this laid on top of one another. Like there are, because I was recently visiting Canterbury, and it was interesting to be reading this book at the same time, because I was doing a very similar thing. One of the things that I struggled with this book, right, was that it takes quite a long time for him to give quite a concrete description of the hinterland, what it is describing, the historical economic process that brought it about. And so I sort of struggled to parse it from an otherwise just sort of almost conventional description of economic growth and then crisis. And I think in a lot of respects, actually what he is giving is a description of the history of the past, well, the sort of post-war boom and then bust in the United States, and how the economic structure of the country grew with that and then declined. I think you can find those places. There are certainly places analogous to what's described in this text in the UK, but I think also the scale is different, and there are sort of pockets of deprivation everywhere. Like almost everywhere's got sort of a council estate, you know, and everywhere's got a population that's potentially being left behind by new waves of gentrification or inward migration or something, which is happening all over Kent. I just feel like Kent is just like entirely a commuter belt, the commuter space for London. And what it felt like to me was there's just so much more wealth there than there is where I'm now living. Like, but anyway, yeah, I think we could probably come back to this, I think, actually, because we can illustrate what the hinterland is, and what elements of economic activity, I suppose, allow for the maintenance of a surviving economy and a thriving economy and population, or what things, as they retreat, leave behind them all of the symptoms of the deprivation that he's describing. And I think we will find those in the relevant examples that we know of in the UK as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're right. Everywhere has a council estate or like two or three or four and an industrial estate, right? And then also the part of town where it's just like loaded people commuting from London, right? Yeah. So you're absolutely right.
But it was funny. Like I was on the coach back from Kent to Cornwall, and like the coach stop for Reading is just like just off the M5, and you're sort of driving past the outskirts of Reading, and it's just like, what I assume are like just call centers, like a huge Verizon call center or something, like office block, and there's like loads of different office blocks for various different multinational corporations, which are a feature of like sort of elements of the sort of like immediate exurbs that make up the near hinterland that Neil describes in this book, kind of thing. So
yeah, it's funny. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about, exactly where you're talking about. And when I've been past there on that bus trip, it's just like, I remember being very homesick for LA, because it's just like, oh, these warehouses with just like some fucking huge logo slapped on the front. It's just like, I know it well. It's almost weird seeing it in an English context, but yeah. So another, yeah. So just to go off that, and so we'll get into it a little bit. He begins this, you were talking about scale. He begins this by talking about his travels in China. I mean, he's you know, talking with the people who live in China's massive hinterlands and massive cities. And he basically, that's kind of his introduction to describing the hinterland at all. He doesn't start with America. He starts with China. And he is like, you know, we kind of all think about this hinterland of China and we can all kind of picture it. But the only difference between that and America is one of scale. You know, Americas are just smaller, as crazy as that is to say, right? So I'll begin with, I'll quote something that he says a bit later on in the book when he's kind of trying to discuss, he's discussing the similarities between Shenzhen in China and Houston, which is very funny because these are both cities I imagine that are just like massive urban sprawl because there's no zoning or literal physical geographic limits to the sprawl of these cities. They're just massive hinterlands on top of hinterlands, on top of suburban zones, on top of urban zones. And so he says, rather than attempting to pin down what exactly is the proper outer border of such a city, it makes more sense simply to acknowledge that the old categories of urban, suburban, and rural may simply have less explanatory power for the contemporary capitalist city than they once had. Instead, we can define clear islands of affluence encircled by a near hinterland composed of identifiable industrial logistics expanses that gradually fade into a farther hinterland of agriculture, black markets, and half-abandoned fields, factories, and forests. So that's kind of like the key, categorization that he makes here in his kind of like communist geography, which is the cities, the urban zones, and then the hinterland, which he splits up into the far hinterland and the near hinterland. And I feel like I actually can kind of picture this pretty well. I do know kind of exactly what he's talking about. And it was good to kind of see this formalized a little bit. And, you know, he kind of rips apart kind of what the material processes are at work here in all of these different zones. And so maybe I guess we just start to break those down. I mean, cities, I don't know how much we need to expand on cities. We know what cities are, right? Mm-hmm. They're like these big things that we need to do away with. If I learned anything from our last reading.
I mean, maybe coming back to this, I guess we've got sort of like three examples perhaps of the development of a sort of geography of the urban, the populated development of a country and an economy, right? We've just been talking about one of them. We've got sort of like the United Kingdom, we've got Western Europe, in which there are cities which developed a sort of a structure that was almost pre-capitalist in some ways. And he talks about this sort of saying that like, there's something about the nature of London and other European cities, which encapsulate in a more concrete way, this idea of like, a city center and a sort of like suburban belt kind of thing. And whereas in the United States, there's an adoption of some of that, but there is a sort of maybe even a more properly capitalist, there is a geography that relates to a more fully developed capitalist economy. And then perhaps the examples that he's drawing from China are even like, more developed version of that. Now there are things about this, just this general scale of China, you know, that the population is massive, the economy is huge, the speed at which all of that infrastructure was built was purely designed to facilitate a growth of a particular and maintenance of a particular type of economy, a particular type of working population. But there are sort of like economic developments within that as well, I suppose. But it was only when he gets into these that sort of those middle sections of this book where he's actually describing the city that I sort of began to understand what he was actually getting at when he talked about the hinterland, because like he starts to talk about the things that make a city viable almost. And he talks about the sort of like, because we're in a situation of now global capitalism and the trade, the flows of capital, both, I guess, financial, but also like material products, can spread across the continent, can spread across the world. And so what you need to have a sort of functioning, economically prosperous sort of like urban center, I suppose, is like a degree of connectivity to be like a nodal point in that global exchange of capital, I guess. Yeah,
but in like a weird way too, though, because it isn't like, I feel like the kind of more bourgeois, like 1950s view of the city, which is like skyscrapers and the center of industry, the hustle and bustle, is actually like, he's making the point here, it's kind of outdated as far as that was ever actually true, right? Like his point is that cities now are kind of hives for very specific types of commerce. So he lists like the fire industries, which are what, finance, insurance, and real estate, right? Yeah, and then like various producer services, so would that be like law, marketing bullshit, right? But then also his bugbear, the creative industries, which whenever he uses the word creative, he's like takes pains to put it in air quotes, which I thought was very funny. But it, you know, it really makes sense. It's like the urban centers are very much these things. And my personal reference frame of reference for all of this stuff is Los Angeles, which is like the perfect encapsulation of what he's talking about here. It's actually kind of a patchwork of all of these different things. But then, as he says, you get further and further away from the, you know, urban core or whatever, away from the skyscrapers. You start to get these industries that I suppose like bourgeois ideology would probably look down upon a bit, right? Like typically it's like the rural areas, but it's also extractive industries. And then when you get really far away, it's the like black market kind of stuff, right? And that's kind of the distinction that he makes between the far hinterland and the near hinterland. Far hinterland is like rural, extractive, a little bit of industry, right? And then, oh no, I'm sorry, I got that backwards. The near hinterland is like the more suburbs. It's the kind of like banlieues in Paris. It's commuter belts. And it's also just slums if you talk about the near hinterland in, say, Guatemala or something like that, right? The far hinterland is, you know, is the rural extractive industry, like industrial processing and all sorts of stuff like that. And where you really start to get more of the black markets and things like that. And again, like, I'll keep bringing up my frame of reference for this because, like, Los Angeles downtown, it's marketing and it's law firms and it's all sorts of dumb shit like that. And then you also have obviously Hollywood, which is the pocket for his, you know, creative industry hate. But then you also like as you get further away, you know, you have the valley, which is like, you know, the suburbs. You have your commuter towns and stuff like that. And then the perfect example of what he's talking about for the far hinterland is, you know, the mining or the rural industries of the Central Valley, and then the like marijuana plantations way up north, right? Like cannabis plantations that are like kind of legal, but also like incredibly sketchy and rely on really poorly treated immigrant labor. So yeah, that's kind of like his general three-piece guide to understanding the world. And it's interesting, right? Because it's like he very much couches this in saying, you know, capitalism is this global system. There's nothing outside of capitalism anymore. And all of these industries rely on each other. It's not like the farming is less important than the marketing or anything like that. This is just necessarily the way that capitalism has organized itself geographically. And you can basically around the world, you'll see mirror images of this wherever you go. You know what I mean? You'll see in California, you'll see it in the UK in a kind of like a weird way. and you'll see it in China, you'll see it in Australia, you'll see it everywhere. It's very interesting.
I mean, he describes the urban centers of the world as being all identical in a lot of respects. Like, I mean, they house the same industries, but like they're just sort of sold as glass skyscrapers. And like, I mean, he enjoys also poking fun at like what I presume is like hipster coffee shops with like, all that have the same counter.
My
and
man
the same
hates
layout
coffee
and,
shops.
Obviously, one of the things that I always enjoy about a text is if it gives a sort of historical explanation of an economic process. And so much of this is about the sort of push factors that affect the movement of people throughout history. And one of the things he's talking about that correlates with what you were saying is the kind of like how city centers don't particularly, for the most part, like don't house like the urban poor anymore. There's been this sort of like process of like, there is this idea, and in the 1950s or whatever, you had the creation of like your conventional urban center, and then you had sort of like potentially like primarily white suburbs, more affluent. But in some ways, there's been the opposite movement, right? And we can all recognize this. This is sort of this gentrification of the city center, and actually those people that would have been the poor population of the city center have now come to populate the former, or in some places anyway, former wealthy suburbs. And the people who work in those places are largely in a lot of ways like facilitating the service economy that services, I suppose, the financial centers, I guess. Like he describes working in a factory that makes sandwiches that are sort of prepackaged that will go into the city center and either like be part of buffets in rich boardroom meetings or what have you. But the same, you can see the same in like London, right? Where all the people that work in the service economies, I don't mean like financial services, obviously, I mean like conventional service economy of like central London. Nobody lives there, right? Everybody's commuting in to like work in the food courts in the shopping centers or whatever. And then in some ways he describes the opposite effect, right? You've got his far hinterland, which once at the sort of boom of American industry, the sort of like, so I sort of picture it like there was this economic process in the mid 20th century where America boomed, the sort of tendrils of wealth flowed from these urban centers and reached much deeper into the US. And so these the sort of like transfer of wealth, but also the sort of the general economic flows were more substantive. So if you had a degree of raw resource extraction going on in the United States, which doesn't exist in the same way as it used to or on the same scales. You have degrees of manufacturing, which once again don't happen on the same scales because there's been wholesale deindustrialization. The wealth just doesn't reach into the far hinterland anymore. So you have inward migration from the far hinterland into the near hinterland, and you have sort of outward migration from the urban center to the near hinterland. And what he's creating toward the sort of like leads to the culmination of this book is a picture of the near hinterland, which is a sort of new, in some ways like class melting pot, but like racial melting pot, but like where all the same economic forces are driving people to the same place from different places. And it's sort of creating the new sort of fertile ground for revolutionary class action, I guess.
For the ultra left.
For the ultra left, yes.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's one of the reasons, right, that he says that the word suburbs isn't particularly useful anymore, because like the connotations of suburbs are like relatively affluent white commuter towns where everybody has their little castle and their Hummer and they commute in to whatever tire factory they own or whatever, right? But he's basically, you know, he, one of the autobiographical sections of this talks about him going down to Ferguson when all of the riots were going on down there. And he was saying this, you know, Ferguson is like now a predominantly black working class neighborhood. Obviously, we had the Ferguson riots there because of the just many instances of murder by police and police brutality that take place in St. Louis pretty frequently. This was one of the hotbeds during Obama's term. I forget exactly what year it was. Like one of the big rebellions of recent American history, right? But he makes a term where he's like, you know, calling the suburbs of St. Louis doesn't exactly do it justice. It is the near hinterlands, and it the suburbs doesn't exactly describe adequately the historical process that you're describing, Dan, that like, you know, that has made this place a hotbed of revolutionary ferment. It's interesting. And I also really like the like nuance that he gives. He doesn't go into this a whole lot, but like if you think about a city like Los Angeles, there's the urban core and then there's like miles of kind of like weird warehouses and industry that nobody goes to, like whole cities that are just industry that nobody goes to unless they're like working there or commuting there, right? And then there's like the suburbs again, and then there's more warehouses, and then there's the suburbs, and then there's the ports, right? And so it's interesting because it's like you have kind of these little pockets of hinterlands and then smaller urban cores within cities. He gives the example of Houston about how some estimates put it. This is going to be, I think, slightly incorrect, but he says that some estimates say that there are like 15 cores of Houston just because it's so massive that little kind of whole cities have sprung up there. I mean, there's like the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington metropolitan area, right, as well. So it's just interesting. I do like that there's nuance there where he isn't just saying that this is strictly geographic. You have one urban core, you have one city, and then slowly it just fades out. They're very much like patchworks of these different areas in all cities. Yeah.
And he sort of – there is another – an analogous geography load over this, but on a sort of smaller scale where he's talking about there being certain locales that are sort of like – not tied into global flows of capital in the same way, but they function as like state centers or particular counties that for one reason or other represent the same sort of have the same traits of a functioning capital center, but like on a smaller scale. So like they have a river port, or they have some I guess in the UK, you could say they have some kind of like historical thing which draws in tourism, but he talks about like recreational centers, you know, like he talks about places in Colorado that I assume, like, I don't know what happens in Colorado, skiing or something. But anyway, so it's like it's not, as you say, like there's a deeper nuance to the picture that's being painted. That isn't sort of like wholly simplistic.
Yeah. As much as I'd like it to be wholly simplistic. Oh, yeah. I mean, we are simple.
Well, I speak for myself. I am a simpleton. So.
Oh, no. By all means. Oh, speak for the show. By all means. So should we get into talking a little bit about the kind of like class implications then of this geography? Because this book is like part geography, I suppose, and then also part mainly sociology. And the weird thing is he begins his sociology and almost begins the entire book by talking about the like idiot patriot groups that are in the like west of the United States, which are just like always ever a source of mirth and jest for me, because it just makes me laugh every time I remember that these groups exist. So he's talking about the like fave of the show, like Eamon Bundy kind of groups, right? The people who are always like, goddamn Bureau of Land Management, goddamn George Soros telling me I can't graze my cattle on public lands. And this is all to kind of have a sociological description of the far right and its various organizations as they exist in the United States. And on one hand, it was pretty grim. But then on the other hand, he was also like, these are pretty localized groups and not particularly capable of organizing a working class population. And so he's like, you know, you don't have to be hugely scared of them. They're bad, I mean, and they're terrible, but they're not, you know.
Yeah, initially I was frustrated that he started the book with this, and as I was saying before, like, doesn't offer the full description of the hinterland and the sort of political and geographical analysis that he's doing until later in the book. But I think there are probably reasons why he does that, right? One of them might just be that they're fun to make fun of and will sort of draw people in with it, and like that particularly when he's writing this book in 2017, like, Trumpism is a new phenomenon, and sort of like trying to and what he does, to his credit obviously, is like give that movement a historical context that goes all the way back to the reaction to Obama, and like how those political trends and the movements that are attendant to it have sort of developed through that time. And I think also the reason why he does it is because he wants to get them out of the way and say these people do not represent for him the far hinterland, or they don't represent the politics of the far hinterland. They don't represent the sort of like inherent ideology, the acquired beliefs of people who live in the far hinterland in rural America. But what he is saying is that the far right is exploiting aspects of the developments in class that are attendant to his analysis that he doesn't think the left are really responding to in the same way. Like, they are the right, as he says, are sort of like, are doing a much better job of recognizing how they can appeal to these people. Although he makes the entirely fair point that, like, the majority of these places didn't vote for Trump, right? Like, the majority of these places just don't vote. The majority of these people aren't part of, like, which are the groups he talks about, like the 3%ers or the Oath Keepers or whatever. So they're on a generalized scale, this ideology doesn't represent the hinterland. And then, as you're saying, like, or as part of what you were saying, was that they're also quite geographically specific and specific to certain material economic circumstances, particularly one around like the relationship to land and the Bureau of Land Management and the Forestry Service, and like how these create conflict points between really what is like aspects of the petty bourgeoisie and or like owners of ranches or mines who have for various reasons are brought into conflict with the state.
Well, I think in that instance, though, it is kind of fair to say that these people are, like, it's not entirely fair to say that they're not products of the far hinterland, because they are. They just don't represent the like working class of the far hinterland, sure. Is, I think, kind of what he's saying.
Yeah.
So, like, just to give a bit more background on these groups, it's like, I think a lot of these groups trace their ideological lineage maybe as far back as like Ruby Ridge, which is something that you just always hear right-wing libertarian far-right idiots bring up all the time, right? It's like the lost cause of Ruby Ridge. But these groups are like, as you say, like pretty localized in the far west, because if you look up a map of where publicly held land is, it's predominantly west from the Rockies west. There's like none in the Midwest, and there's not really any on the East Coast. There's a bit in Appalachia, but that's about it. Something like most of Nevada is publicly owned land, things like that, right? Or like Oregon, places like this. And what these groups are is exactly what you're saying. Like, generally, these are patriot far-right groups that mobilize to protect, you know, encroachment on some petty bourgeois loser's land when the Bureau of Land Management is like, hey, this is our land and you owe us like $1 million in back taxes for letting your cattle graze here. And the interesting thing that he brings up is like these groups have always kind of tried to input some kind of like fascist, racist, far-right political ideology in their organizing, but in recent years that actually hasn't been particularly fruitful for them, because the people that live in the far hinterland kind of just don't really care or are immigrants themselves, and so they've kind of had to readapt their terminology to a kind of economic critique that you actually hear a lot about on the so-called left, which is people who are like, anti-rent seeking, right? Which is, oh man, if only we could return to the real economy. This is like a weird, evil, mirrored version of a lot of like shitty left politics, which is like, you know, the real economy. If only we could bring back industry. If only we could bring back, you know, if only the government would let me clear cut this beautiful forest. If only the government would let me mine my mining claim, I guess, which I'm always find funny that people are still trying to do that. So it's like, you know, the real economy to them would be getting rid of these goddamn rent seekers who sit on things like the Bureau of Land Management. And it's just, it creates this very, very odd kind of like collection of political groups like the Oath Keepers or whatever, or the like, could you come up with a stupider sounding organization than the people who are trying to create like a Nordic utopia outside of like Richmond, Virginia? It's like, it's like, oh my God, that's lame. But it was interesting. It was like a good sociological analysis of these like far right groups that exist in the far hinterland that are, you know, fascists, but still not able to mobilize a large group of supporters. And generally when they do mobilize people, it's just like the fail sons with AR, like fail sons with like automatic rifles who show up to, you know, hassle some clerk in the Bureau of Land Management, right? And then one of them dies and is like a martyr, and it's like this huge thing. Just like everything in America, it's like a weird version of politics that you'd find somewhere else, but much more pathetic and much funnier. It's just like, this is so lame, you guys. And you know, he describes a guy that you see everywhere where I grew up, which is the like, you know, Carhartt wearing, he calls it the Carhartt dynasty. It's like the Carhartt wearing, just picture Amon Bundy, the like cowboy hat with jeans and boots that have never had scuffs on them, never seen mud a day in their life. And you try to appropriate this working class culture to be like, oh, big government's ruining my right to mine gold, I guess.
Yeah, come on, guys, let's go and all protect my right to like exploit your labor. Kind of thing.
It's so good. It's like, come on.
There's an important thing that it comes from what you were just saying there, I think, which it was when you mentioned the sort of like people LARPing some kind of Norse, I don't know, like sort of brotherhood kind of thing. Like, I think there is a process that sort of maps onto economic boom and then also economic bust, right? Like there is a power in a certain right-wing narrative when you're in the conditions of economic decline and there's a desire to potentially like protect from like foreign immigration. It's not people aren't anti-immigration, perhaps there are certainly racist like explicit racist tones to it, but it comes perhaps from a place of like fear of economic decline primarily. And also what does he talk about, like the material culture of capitalism is one of the phrases that he talks about in this, and this is one of the things which comes out quite often in some of his more sort of like literary prose elements, where he's just sort of talking about the like the material experience, the real like visceral experience of living in these places under a form of lifestyle which takes you to work and then takes you home again to watch Netflix. It doesn't really connect you to any particular community because you're on the move constantly, and like all relationships become relations of exchange, of economic exchange, of consumption. And there is something that he draws out from various of these groups and the way that they appeal to certain sections of the community, where it's just providing some kind of seemingly real community element, you know, like for the, I've quite forgot what they were called, like the wolf group, right? Like
let's just call them the wolf group.
Yeah, the wolf group. there is sort of like there's a utopianism in an appeal to like some kind of small scale racialized, but maybe not racist, kind of like small community homogeneity. And also for the Oath Keeper group, there's these people who've like sworn themselves to some kind of utopian concept of a higher service, and they've actually had the real material experience of some kind of camaraderie, perhaps in the army or in some other form of like in the fire service or whatever, and a sort of longing for a continuation of that thing, which is increasingly stripped away from the sort of material reality of life under capitalism. So yeah, there's that sort of that was what was interesting to me as a thing that he sort of like as a force that he's identifying.
Anyway. Yeah, the thing is too though is that like liberals would see these people, you know, these Oath Keeper types, which is just like, God, come up with better names, please. And they'd be like, look at these idiots. Look at these Trump voting idiots. Why can't be smarter, you idiots, mm-hmm. right? And this just ties into the like, he has this great section at the beginning where he compares the wealthy urbanite of Damascus during various like Assyrian revolution as looking out from their high rise and being like, where the hell did these people come from? Right. And he compares that to the like wealthy liberal living in one of the, what he calls twin peninsulas of America, either on the East Coast or on the West Coast, looking out at, you know, whether it's like Occupy or BLM riots, and being like, where did these people come from? Or where did the Trump voters come from? Right. Like how did Hillary lose? Hillary couldn't have lost. Where did these people come from? And it's like, if you're looking at these Oath Keeper types, you have to be like, well, they're being rational for their situation. They're idiots. Sure. No one's disputing that. These are very dumb, idiot, racist morons. But like, if you don't have an understanding of class, you're not going to understand what's going on, because it's like these people, their grandpappies or whatever, probably had a very successful mining claim or a very successful tire change business or a very successful timber company, and now they're seeing their livelihoods dwindle away, and you know, these rent seekers are coming in and telling them what they can and can't do, and so what do? They blame the liberals on the East Coast and on the West Coast. They build these conspiracies, anti-Semitic conspiracies. They build all these different things, and they become Trump people, right? And, you know, it's like a similar thing that happens to working class people. He talks about this a lot, about how some of the biggest potential for communist revolutionary activity is in the white, what would you call it, like the poorest segments of the white population in America, because they've seen their livelihoods go from the baby boomer generation, where it was like, hey, things are pretty good, I can kind of just coast, to now it's like, wait a minute, I'm living on a trailer park, what happened? And to him, that's kind of like the virtue of the working class, is that if it's nurtured, will lead to revolutionary foment, as opposed to like, you know, racist George Soros conspiracy kind of bullshit. But yeah, I mean, these people, you know, people act rationally, even if they're acting quote unquote irrationally, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, he sort of champions the narrative which says that it's not sort of like constant impoverishment and immiseration which creates a revolutionary moment, but one where a future is taken away, almost like there is progress and then there is a sudden decline and a sort of loss of possibility. And that's something that runs throughout this book. He sort of refers to it again with different groups as to sort of representing that revolutionary potential. I wanted to bring up the way he uses the idea of power, because I think it sort of links the beginning section of this book when he's talking about these aspects of right politics, which speaks in some ways to the sort of needs of the hinterland, and in relation to how the left operates and should operate. And I mean, I guess one aspect of this is the ways in which what he's saying the right is doing correctly is just meeting people's need. And like, it's quite interesting, actually, like he talks about this and through an analysis of insurgent and counterinsurgency, sort of like military analysis kind of thing. Like the reason why an insurgent group in one of the myriad Middle East countries invaded by the United States succeeds is not because people are initially won over by their political or religious rhetoric. It's that they have material power and they can meet people's needs. And they usually start by actually just like trying to service the community in some way. And like a political fealty comes after a general recognition that these people have something that you need and they can benefit you.
Well, more than that too, it's just that there is a group that has power at all. I think that was also one of his points.
Yeah. Particularly in the hinterland where there's just like no real nobody has connection anything. To like, yeah, nobody has yeah. anything, right? And he chastises quite viscerally what we would recognize as being the organized left. Obviously, there's sort of like the liberal left that is represented by the NGO or the sort of like Democratic Party or what have you, that demands a certain type of political, social sort of propriety in the way you conduct your politics before they will engage or what have you. What I mean by that is like a commitment to like quote unquote nonviolence or a particular strategic and tactical repertoire. And then also he's sort of talking about the sort of like programmatic centered left, which I sort of like take to be the sort of more radical socialist left who again sort of like champion a particular strategy but also demand fealty to a program before simply trying to acquire, demonstrate power, being in a position to lead. And he sort of talks about these series of like from the Arab Spring through to the point when this book is being written, these political movements that are the central hallmark of which is insurrection and riot, occupation. And the people that are able to lead, the people that are most effective are those people who have some kind of organized structure and can demonstrate and wield power and sort of grant power to ordinary people and also sort of indulge their sort of like political impulses, I suppose, and not try to prescribe what should and shouldn't be done, I guess.
It does seem obvious too, doesn't it? When it's like, you know, you might think that you just go wave a program in front of everybody's face and go, this is going to solve everything. Yeah. Trust me, this will solve everything. They're just going to kind of go, who are you?
Where's my copy of the newspaper gone?
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking that. But it's like, people are just going to be like, who are you? What are you doing? How are you going to influence anything at all? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, I suppose that there are different versions of coming to terms with that fact, because like a lot of people, communists would be like, well, we just need to take our program to the biggest political body that we can find. And whether that's rentierism or like joining a sub-faction of the big bourgeois party, I'm thinking of like the DSA or something like that. Like that's an attempt to get around this. But what he's really saying is like power actually needs to be demonstrated first. And then that's what drives people to you. And it's a good way of, you know, kind of thinking about the small amounts of working class people that have been influenced by this bullshit ideology of the like Patriot Group, Oath Keepers or whatever, just because they, you know, they're the only people who offer emergency preparedness courses when you're living in like a wildfire corridor. You know what I'm saying? So it's interesting. He actually even brings up what we've spoken about a bit on this show before, which is like any successful version of organizing will include something like, you know, emergency preparedness courses or the like Black Panther, like I was called it the Black Panther meal deal. That's not what it's called, but the like I forget exactly what it's called. It wasn't the meal
breakfast
deal.
Club or something.
Yeah. I don't think it was the breakfast club either. But it's something along those lines of, you know, again, stepping in where in places where capital can't organize, where the state isn't providing, you know, inner city kids with meals, provide them with meals. And then people will be like, this ideology, I like it. As opposed to trying to put that ideology first and chastising working class people for not following you. Because it's like, realistically, like, why would anybody in their right minds go to the DSA and be like, they'll change everything? Why would anybody go to Socialist Appeal and be like, they'll change anything, you know?
And it's not a political strategy that's unique to the ultra left or what have you. Like, it's just the same idea, I think, of like building class independent organizations, you know, or like building a political strategy predicated on the concept or the sort of like the statement that the job of liberating the working class is for the working class themselves and not for some force above and beyond them, not some political party, not some elite. That feels like the trap that the sort of like small sects of the left fall into at the moment is thinking that they're going to be the nexus point, the sort of like central point of people's liberation. You know, like they're the thing that people are going to flock to.
Yeah. Having said that, though, if only people would just understand labor time planning, that would be fine. Just listen to me. We should touch on the material community of capital stuff. You touched on it a bit before. I think that's kind of key to all of this. And, that's the Jack Kamat jump scare that happens pretty early on, where he's like, French ultra leftist Jack Kamat says. And I was like, oh, it's one of those books. but it's a really interesting idea. And it gives an answer to a question that I think we all need to be asking ourselves, and certainly one that's been on my mind a lot as we've kind of read more and more stuff, which is like, where did the workers' movement go? What happened to it? Why no more communism anymore? Why aren't people interested in where are all of the Lenin posters? What happened to the good old days? You know what I mean? Which is to basically say, like, during the earlier parts of the 20th century, as we entered in the specific phase of subsumption of capital, like, there were a lot of people involved in, well, depending on who you ask, there was a proportion of people that were involved in the actual like heart of productivity of the global production chain, right? And this led to working class organizations using the mass strike as a tool, using trade unions as a tool, and using social democracy as a tool to kind of try and get past capitalism. And now we don't really have that anymore. We have strikes, but they're kind of infrequent. And when they do happen, they're just to get better wages. Of course, you still have wildcat strikes when people are fed up with their fucking unions. We have unions, but they basically just translate the language of working class energy into one that management understands. And so what's going on? What's different now? Where can we turn to for kind of communist organizing? Because it's not like things have changed where all of a sudden we don't need a classless society. Communism is still very much the thing that is going, or like whatever, communism, anarchism, socialism, whatever. Like, this is still kind of the key to having a livable world, right? And I don't need to convince anybody of this, that classless societies are good. And he kind of says, he brings up this idea of the material community of capital as the thing that binds everybody together, which is shared experiences, I suppose, of things being shitty. That seems to just be the really simple way to put it. And it's interesting because the author Phil Neal makes a point where he's like, you know, I grew up poor. I grew up in a rural area. In theory, by the like workers theory stuff, that should make me able to organize with a like Guatemalan immigrant working in the strawberry fields in Central California, but it doesn't. And it's really difficult to organize with those people. So what's the difference? And he says, the difference is that, you know, I suppose like just different experiences. But he says the experiences that everybody has are ones of the material community of capital, of, I suppose, like, and tell me if I'm getting any of this wrong, because I'm still like, maybe like 70% sure I get it, but it's like, hey, I hate my landlord, man. Yeah, man, work sucks, doesn't it? Oh man, I wish I could just not work. Old things like that. Like, oh man, I hate having to pay for the gasoline in my car. And the language of this, I suppose, isn't the mass strike anymore. It's the riot. And this is where I kind of understood, oh, okay, this is where all of these people get the kind of like riot theorizing from. Because this is just an expression of things are bad, man. And it's the material community of capital. It's, man, things suck. It sure would be better if they were different. And that's kind of the like mass strike of the 21st century, I suppose. It's an interesting idea. And like I said, that's been a question, the workerist stuff that's been on my mind a lot recently. And so it was good to kind of get a response to that stuff.
Yeah, I think the way I'm thinking about it, and that, thinking about that transition of like, okay, how does the development of the capitalist economy and the sort of proletariat relationship to its place in it changed over time, and why does that create for Neil and other ultra leftists this sort of change in the sort of tactical repertoire, I suppose. And yeah, it sort of sounds like what he's proposing is that workers are not now in the position to shut down production at sort of production sites almost. But what they do find themselves doing is sort of like disrupting flows of capital between places, if that makes sense, I guess. Like we can see how the capitalist economy sort of flows in to these nodal points of connection within sort of chain of capitalist production. He's sort of almost saying this sort of like the material conditions that make the proletariat what it is have changed. And in some ways they're sort of increasingly proletarianized in the sense that they're even more propertyless, I guess. Like they don't even really have their own labor as a reliable thing, a reliable commodity to fall back on when engaging the capitalist economy. And it's just this nice point of like, in the end, I think he sort of like, he connects the sort of like D-class A, sort of college educated, sort of downwardly mobile, quote unquote, creative industry person with the near hinterland sort of economic migrant through this position of both being increasingly precariatized by the capitalist economy, I guess. So there's this sort of connective, unique experience of a sort of loss of an economic function. Therefore, a place in the economy isn't a way to exercise political power anymore. And therefore, it needs another tactical repertoire, I guess. One which is a sort of attendant to the riot, but he certainly seeks to overcome that, I think. Although he doesn't really give an answer to what that will look like. But I think he thinks it will be emergent from the struggle. And what it requires is a connection to the question of power, I suppose, and how we can find new ways to exercise it, I guess. But like, no, yeah. I'm just making it up.
Well, he quotes Jasper Burns as well in this. And like I said, when we read Jasper Burns for the show, what Phil Neal is putting forward here, it's the most fun version of organizing that you can come up with. It's just like, it's some, in people who would maybe be operating in bad faith would call this adventurism. It's kind of just like, I don't know though. It does kind of make sense. And I do kind of like the like theoretical background that he gives to this idea of like, you know, supporting the riot. And basically he kind of comes down on your strategy just needs to be pushing these moments of insurrection as far as they can go as an end to themselves, kind of. I mean, you know, there's nothing in this book, because this isn't a book on strategy, there's nothing in this book about like what that would look like necessarily and what goals you would be having. But it's basically, from what I can tell, it's the Jasper Burns communist action thing. Just push things as far as they can go for the sake of it, man, which could probably be a bit irresponsible in some hands, you know what I mean? But you also see what he's talking about, like when the proletariat is defined by its dispossession way more so than its privileged access to the means of production, to the machines that make the, you know, to the power looms powered by the steam engine. Like, that's not anybody, right? Like, And even if it was, the capitalists would just fire you and go get somebody else. Like, when that's the case, these moments of insurrection are what matters. And that's true. It's just a matter of how you give the meaning beyond the acts themselves. Maybe some of the more ultra-left types would say, you don't have to. That is the end to itself. It'll figure itself out. You know, whatever. But one other thing that I thought it was – that I thought was really interesting just really quickly was when he was like, the ability of these actions to be successful has depended on recently the ability for the riots, insurrections in the urban cores to draw from the near and far hinterlands of people who are pissed off. It's interesting. I was in Paris during a lot of the Yellow Vest stuff. And yeah, those people, I mean, explicitly, those people were like the pissed off people about the gas tax coming from around Paris or even like further away in France. And he gives the examples of riots in Syria, in Egypt.
Hong Kong.
And so, yeah, it's interesting. What did you make of the the communist oath stuff, because I don't think I understood this.
I mean, I completely forgotten. I'm really glad that you bring it up, because like then it's another way sort of like circles back around to the beginning of the book, right? Like, like there is this sort of like, it's sort of analogous to this sort of like power over program question. It's about, just finding the thing that bonds people in a more to a more organic kind of community, I guess. He starts by literally talking about this sort of Oathkeeper group, and in the beginning of the book, he sort of talks about oaths of blood, right? And as being this thing which binds, potentially binds communities on the right, but that are potentially sort of like racially homogenous, but also have some kind of commitment to maintaining the existing order, or like or don't extend their insurrectionary politics toward a sort of like a trajectory that represents a development in history toward sort of the universalistic moment of communism, I guess. For him, sort of like communism represents a universalism. And he, as a reflection on the necessary sort of like conditions for a productive political movement, I think it's, I really appreciate a discussion of like what would bind people together more than a simple like well thought out academic scientific analysis of conditions, I suppose, and something that would represent more thoroughly a sort of moment of real organic bonding of a community. I mean, I hope everybody has experienced some aspect of that. You know, I can't remember the phrase that he uses to contrast to the material community of capitalism. Like, this, maybe it's just like an organic community or something like that. Sort of hope everybody. Maybe I feel like I've experienced small elements of that. Because he's sort of writing a book and creating create a nice arc, and there's something poetic about what he's saying. He talks about like oaths of water, right, as opposed to oaths of blood. That like, I feel like just this idea that there needs to be something that connects people, a sort of like almost ephemeral connection to a movement, to a happening, to a moment, I guess, to an event. I just borrow as many words from the sort of ultra left as I can think of, represents a real powerful thing that you need to have in a successful movement, I think. I mean, I don't know whether I've just explained what he means very well, but
no, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do think the commitment to action, that stuff, the stuff about power and about how you build that and the criticisms of people waving a program under working class people's noses and then being like, you idiots, why won't you come join my party? It's all very, very good. Yeah. This stuff just needs to be merged with like a coherent theory of value, because like, I don't know, a lot of these, like this, I'm just not talking about Phil Neal at all. No, I'm just talking about like more ultra left stereotypes. A lot of them are like value form people. And it's like, that leads them to maybe not having a theory of what breaking value production would actually look like, or what communist society would actually look like beyond just like, rationing, you know what I mean? And it's like, I don't know, whatever we read, I wind up agreeing with whatever we read the most recently. But like, this stuff is good, and like, it's a really good answer to what it is that you can actually be doing as opposed to what it is that the class actually needs to be doing, because communists get that confused all the time. They confuse the two things. And if you do that, you're going to wind up just having a program that outlines what everybody needs to be doing. And again, you're going to scoff at people when they don't listen to you, and probably turn into a bit of a reactionary, as happens a lot on the left. But like, I don't know. It's funny because I know that when we read Jasper Burns, he quoted Gilles Duvet, who I kind of had always thought of as like an anti-labor tokens guy. And Dove was, basically just being like, I actually don't understand that stuff, so don't listen to me. And I was just like, I respect that. Yeah. I think that's cool. But yeah, this stuff, the only reason I bring that up is because it's like, okay, here's how you build power. Here's how you do this. Here's how you get people to listen to you. Then what? You know what I mean? And yeah, it's good. And I mean, you know, his thesis here is that the hinterland is going to be this, for all the reasons we've described and more reasons, is going to be this new theater of class conflict where class conflict can actually succeed. You know, he talks about the difference between, he doesn't use Paris specifically, but like the difference in riot control in a place like Paris versus riot control in Ferguson, where like in Ferguson, you know, the National Guard just kind of had to retreat to like protecting the local Chuck E. Cheese or whatever. And they couldn't do anything else because there's not, you know, cities are kind of designed for riot control, whereas the hinterland isn't. As well as, you know, the obvious things to a Marxist, poverty rates, sharp declines on the J curve, which is not something I'd ever heard about before, but seems like an interesting economic tool. So yeah, it's very good. The hinterland, it's interesting. And hopefully this will just make more communists not just turn up their nose at the hinterlands as like, you know, meth dens and idiot petty bourgeois people, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I love the analysis. I'm very grateful that it's rooted in a historical materialist analysis of economic developments. I think there's a huge amount of truth in it. I think it it's analysis of how this has created a new landscape of class, which relates to what should be a correct prescription for left organizing, is incredibly provocative, I guess. The thing that always makes it difficult for me to break with like the sort of like workerist left fully, I suppose, is that we do need some kind of economic program. Like we do need what do we do the day after the revolution, you know, like, and we do need to be thinking about this beforehand because, I mean, in some ways maybe the flows of capitalism are becoming so alien to us, I guess, that it's just impossible for us to take it on board and reshape it and create a productive system which is analogous to what was envisaged by early 20th century communism, I guess. But I guess also it's worth remembering perhaps that the text that is our touchstone for what a communist economic program should be was written by a group of ultra leftists, I guess, of a different, yeah, of a far different stripe, right?
Ultra leftists, like, of their time.
It's the councilists.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully somebody figures it out, Dan. Yeah. That would be pretty cool. We'll read their, once that person figures we'll it out, that. We'll read their book. And we'll go,
We're like, I think we're like, we are some guys, but we're not the guys.
Oh, no.
Like,
we're like, never claimed to be the guys.
No, no.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. You gotta keep reading the ultra left stuff to keep you young. You know what I'm saying? You gotta keep reading the ultra left stuff. I was disturbed by how much I was like, I understand and agree with this. I was like, okay, because it's really easy, and he kind of points this out, it's really easy to read the coming insurrection stuff or whatever, or even endnotes, and be like, you know, just kind of like roll your eyes and be like, yeah, okay, Frenchy. But he unfortunately does lay it out very clearly here, and it's like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. I get it now. What are you gonna do?
Highly recommend this. Thank you to the listeners that recommended it to us. I'm very grateful.
Very grateful. Yeah. Hinterland, a classic. Oh, yeah. We didn't even talk about, we said at the beginning we were going to like use this to talk about current events. We didn't even talk about Trump, which is like a core feature of this book. So if you would like to understand a bit more of like, where did all of these people come from who voted for Trump? This is pretty good.
Yeah. You know. And nor did we cycle back to a geographical analysis of Kent or Cornwall or the hinterland in between. But
I think all you need to know about that is just like, it's not, it's what we said. It's more nuanced than that. There are parts of Canterbury that are like commuter belt rents are really high. Then there are the industrial estates and the council estates and everything. And it's like that everywhere.
But also you could do worse if you are in a position to choose, you could do worse than to live in a place which is close, like geographically close to urban center, but also is a university town that also has some tourist trade. And in the case of where I live also has a functioning port of some sort.
And there's nothing nefarious going on in that port at all. No. Nothing nefarious at all. You know, it's funny.
I mean, the nefarious activity that goes on in that port is repairing the super yachts of the uber wealthy.
You know? I remember going out to the port and seeing a like what was probably a like 40-50 foot sailboat. And then I looked to the left and there was one that just dwarfed it. And I was just like, who are these people? Like, give me a break. What are you going to do? It's funny, though. I was thinking about like the university town just in relation to this. And I was like, I've lived here for like 6 years and my job prospects have always either been work in food service, work in retail, work at a university. And that's it. It's like, so if you, you know, it's like, it's better than, I guess, working in like the mines that he describes. Material community of capital, though, still kind of sucks. still kind of sucks. What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah.
Such is life. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan. Another ultra left book ticked off the list. We'll get through them all one day.
Yes. Next stop, the coming insurrection.
Oh, God. All right. Talk to everybody later. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for the show.
Hey everybody, Jack here. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. The song that you heard on this episode is Music to Kill Bad People To by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. You can go ahead and check this song out and much, 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 much more on their Bandcamp at kinggizzard.bandcamp.com. If you want to go ahead and get in touch with us, chat shit, tell us that we're wrong, whatever you want to do, you can go ahead and do that at auxiliarystatements@gmail.com. You can just send us a message there, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter, on Discord, on Instagram. You're a smart person. You can find these places. We got a YouTube. We post stuff there as well. Sometimes we stream. Thank you so much for listening. Till next time.